Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today I'm joined by Meredith. She is a lawyer and secretary of the Libertarian Party in Contra Costa County. Is that in California?
Yes, that is in the Bay Area of California. We're about 20 miles east of San Francisco.
And what have been some of your successful methods in communicating the ideas of freedom to progressives?
Well, basically, I realized a long time ago that there are certain words that progressives hear and they just shut down. I used to call myself an anarcho-capitalist. I've stopped doing that because not even just progressives, liberals, all different kinds of people just shut down immediately upon hearing the word capitalism, capitalist, et cetera. So I've stopped using that term. I have stopped defining myself to people. For the most part, although I do call myself more of a voluntarist, whichever way you want to call it, on Twitter. But I mean, to these people, they don't understand what that is. I've now just started explaining my positions to them rather than defining what I am. I do tell people usually I don't believe in politics. And we go from there. I found that once you explain the ideas to people without putting a label on them, a lot of people actually agree with me. So it's kind of funny that we can't talk to each other and we're at each other's throats when it seems like, you know, reasonable, non-coercive positions are appealing to large groups of people, especially in the uber progressive liberal Bay Area.
Definitely. One of the biggest things when I was first getting into politics was gay marriage. And you would just hear progressives relentlessly defend the freedom of two consenting adults to do whatever they want with their life, really. So right. Getting them to extend that to the economic realm, you'd think that would be within our arsenal, or just the concept of equality. Yeah, if you don't have the right to do it, then government officials shouldn't have the right to. I mean, calling that anarcho-capitalism it hurts my ears to say those words because they hear chaos, exploitation. I'm not going to spend too much time listening to that. Yeah.
They keep saying, oh, so you want corporations to rule everything. And I'm like, I'm about as anti-corporate as it comes. Like, I don't care about corporations. I want to rule me, you to rule you. And as long as, you know, don't hurt me, don't take my stuff, we're good.
How did you become a libertarian?
Well, it's actually funny that you mentioned gay marriage. So I grew up with relatively conservative parents, you know, your basic Republicans. Although I found out that my dad apparently did have a little bit of an anarchist phase, which is hilarious if you knew my dad. I grew up in Philadelphia, actually. So it was a lot more of a combination. Where I live now, it's dominant, progressive, liberal forever. Philadelphia, you know, it was a lot more mixed. And I always sort of leaned conservative basically from the inputs and influence of my parents. As I think most people do when they're first getting into politics, you sort of come off your parents' influence. And one thing that always sort of bothered me was I've always been really cool about the gays. I grew up as a competitive horseback rider. My trainers were gay. You know, lots of people, pretty much every man, not every man, but a lot of the men involved in the sport are gay. And I remember asking my mom as like a 7-year-old, like, what's gay mean? And she just said, it means that a man can love another man instead of a woman. And I was like, great. So ever since then, I was really cool with gay people. And it bothered me that the people that I considered on my side politically didn't feel the same way. And I just remember, I guess, the first time I was in one of my first poli-sci courses in college, I remember the professor defining libertarianism as essentially do whatever you want as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. And I was like, that's me. That is me. Because I don't really define myself with conservative principles at all, except to the extent that they are more likely to try, at least, you know, say that they care about limiting government and things like that. We know that doesn't always work in practice. So I was more likely to side with them on things like that, but I was not likely to side with them on a lot of social issues. So that sort of was my basic introduction into libertarianism. And then what really got me there was a lot of war issues of the war. because that is what I ended up doing in college, studying mostly the wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and all of that. And it just drove me crazy to learn all of the truths of those horrible, horrible interventions.
What were some of the truths that you were previously misled about?
Well, I was in Philadelphia during 9/11. I was 13. And although obviously we weren't hit, it felt very personal to me, even though I wasn't there. I wasn't anywhere near there. I mean, Philadelphia is, you know, 2 hours away. You do know some people who were in the towers and whatnot. And it just felt very personal to me at the time, and kind of beating that drum of patriotism sort of followed naturally to me. And there was always, you know, the idea of like America back-to-back world champs, like, you know, America, fuck yeah. That kind of stuff appealed to me. I don't know why. But then when I remember, it was called Iraq Reconstruction, was the first class I took in college about this area specifically. And I remember watching a movie in the class. I think we watched several, but there was one called Iraq for Sale. And then there was another called No End in Sight. I want to say it was No End in Sight. I remember hearing either Paul Wolfowitz or Walter Slocum discussing how Bush made, I guess, like the structure of who was going to be in charge in the green zone, and talking about kids who were maybe 2 years older than me, who had just graduated college, and making them in charge of, you know, city planning. I remember there being a lot of stuff about traffic lights, and it was because they knew somebody who knew somebody who went to Yale with, you know, President Bush, and all this stuff that I was just like, that is so stupid. That's so unbelievably stupid. Why are we doing this? Why are we coming in there? And we're not even putting in our best and brightest. We're just literally throwing 22-year-olds who don't know anything into this situation when there's people who have lived there their entire lives. I'm going to say this so stupidly. The debathification process, which I'm not sure if everybody would know about that, but that's essentially blackballing everybody who was a member of the Ba'ath Party, was Saddam Hussein, down from, I believe it was levels 1 through 5. 5, by the way, could have been like you're a teacher or you're a driver for somebody, and kicking them out of the ability to participate in society, essentially, when these would have been the people who knew what to do in their own country. That bothered me tremendously. And that just really, the fact that we had no reason to be there and that weapons of mass destruction was a lie just really blew my hat off, in combination with those other things I mentioned.
And there were other explicit lies. He had Bush had said in a presidential address that there was yellowcake uranium going from Niger to Iraq. And then Joe Wilson, who's a progressive who worked for the government and published it in the New York Times, what I didn't find in Africa, credit where credit's due to them, they stopped that story, which is why they exposed his wife, Valerie Plame, as being in the CIA. They also said Mohammed Atta had a meeting with Iraqi intelligence in Prague. I mean, it's not just the
You're just reminding me of things that bothered me.
The misleading stuff is where they get you weapons of mass destruction. Right. Is a grenade a weapon of mass, or is it literally nukes? That's a little vague. People forget they explicitly lied, said things that were totally
specific.
Fake.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember there being a moment where we learned that Colin Powell was never on board. And then all of a sudden he became on board and delivered objectively divorced from reality in a vacuum was an incredible speech, just from like a "are you good at giving speeches" perspective. And knowing that he knew that he was lying really, really messed me up. And a lot of the ideas too, that there was people on there who were like, I want to say it was Walter Slocum, lying through their teeth and laughing about it. He did. There's one point where someone asked him something and he just sort of gives this evil grin and giggle. And I think they were saying that we believe in the middle of the night that these weapons were shipped to Syria. I remember some sort of something about that. And there was another one of those videos, I believe this would have been Iraq for Sale, where we learned about the defense contractors and all of the corruption with that, and how they basically walk these kids into, I mean, they're not kids, they were, you know, 50-year-old truckers, but still walk them into, I want to say it was maybe Fallujah or something, where the road, they had security clearance, the road said black, which was the worst, and they sent them out anyway because, you know, time is money, money is time. And I mean, just all this stuff, learning for the first time, it blew my mind. And it made me feel incredibly guilty as somebody who had no actual input on these issues. I hadn't voted yet ever, but I felt really guilty for my support, as uninformed as it was, of those types of policies before.
Oh, yeah. And it's amazing to see, like, how people are just so so proudly saying, how could, you know, anyone in Russia support invading Ukraine? What's going on there? This is so deliberately immoral. It's like, look, I get it. I'm glad you have some standards. Right. And when you see something, you're against an injustice. However, this is literally the example I used, is the abusive husband who talks about how bad other husbands can be and how sometimes guys who cheat are terrible. Well,
and they're cheating.
But you have no control over them. As far as you go, you're doing a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah.
So high and mighty.
It's fascinating, especially when you think of it from like the little, like how they want to make everything about race. And all of a sudden it's like, well, did you not care about the fact that Iraq was a sovereign country because they were brown? Like, why is Ukraine special and not Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Libya, Syria? The list goes on and on.
Or
I can see one difference.
Ukraine in 2014, when there was a coup supported by Victoria Nuland and the West. Terrible, terrible things. Well, that's great to get your story. What do you see as the role of the Libertarian Party? Actually, I'm sorry. Let me first start with this. Jeremy Kaufman tweeted out that the strong libertarian presence among New Hampshire Republicans has turned marijuana legalization into a Republican issue and made the Democrats pro-cop and pro-prohibition. Five of the six sponsors of this marijuana decriminalization bill are Republicans, and then he lists that. So Jeremy Kaufman's idea is that the libertarians can use this leverage, sort of. So even though it's not that they're going to get a majority, they can go to people in especially Arizona, where I live, and say, hey, Blake Masters, we're going to vote. We're going to tell our people to vote for Mark Victor, who's running, if you don't start supporting insert free issue. So that's right. Jeremy Kaufman's idea of how the LP can actually use its leverage. We should have done it against Trump. What do you see as the role of the LP as secretary of the LP of Contra Costa County?
Well, I mean, I think that he makes a great point. I think that there is somewhat of a difference between doing what he's talking about in a place like New Hampshire and Arizona. Whereas where I am, on principle, you're really not going to get people to vote Republican unless, I mean, they got to come out with a great media campaign or something like that. But I do think that getting people, pushing people with your voter block and, you know, throwing your weight around a little bit is something that I think the local LP should do more. And I think that especially we should be focusing on this in areas like Central California, for example, where, I mean, everyone talks about New York and LA, but Central California is, you know, Kentucky. It is farmland. It is farmers. It is tons of poor brown people, very socially conservative, very hardworking, who don't give a crap about, you know, homeless people's pronouns and whatever, and want to see stuff that materially affects them. And I think we need to focus on things that are winnable and doable rather than at some point we do get to be a little bit of idealists living in Ancapistan in your head. And I think that in California, that's something that we really should be taking advantage of. What we're doing in Contra Costa right now is somewhat different. We are very focused on working with mandates, working to repeal mandates and things like that. We are one of the only counties other than San Francisco and LA who elected to, I mean, when I say elected, I'm talking about the county, not anyone actually voting for this, keep mask mandates and vaccine mandates for longer than the rest of the state did. I was working with Angela McArdle on drafting an initiative here. They actually just voluntarily repealed that right after our XCOM got voted in for the LP of Contra Costa. So we like to say it was because of us, but it really wasn't. But that was something that we were originally planning on working on. And now we're sort of trying to figure out exactly what we're trying to do. Our current chair is my friend Adrian Maladon. He's meeting with local candidates for sheriff, mayor, and things like that, and just getting those connections made and people involved. And we've already got a lot of sheriff candidates reaching out to us. And I think that's important, to get involved with law enforcement to a degree, as much as we might hate them in principle. I think it is important to get involved with them and make sure that the candidates are running are something that we can, like Jeremy Kaufman would say, push on certain issues or at least get behind in whatever way we can.
And certainly, if you look at how the media really tugs at people's heartstrings, it's not necessarily statistics like, you know, King Leopold killed however many people in the Congo. I mean, I hate to say however many, but I've heard a million and 10 million. So when it's something like George Floyd, when it's in your face so much, that really grabs people's attention. There's a case in California, a guy named Elvis Summers, who was building homeless people houses for like $1,000. And they were on private property. He wasn't putting them in the middle of, you know, the freeway. And the houses were outlawed. This was all on Reason magazine. I made a video out
of
it.
I'm ashamed to say I don't know about that. Well, Elvis something?
Yeah, his name was Elvis Summers. I can send you the video I did.
That'd be great.
But their justification was interesting, because just as they say, you know what, if you're going to pay someone $6 an hour, we're going to outlaw that. It has to be at least X amount. So they take that same logic and say, that's not a house. We're not calling that a house. We'd rather that person be homeless. And you're going to have to see the article to realize what to appreciate.
I mean,
what
that
actually
sounds
happened.
Like California.
Because what they literally said, I'm sure, you know, people in any state could do this, but what they literally said was, the reason this is unnecessary is because we have an anti-poverty bill in the works.
So, I mean,
so they said, we can't stop the issue. we can't cure your cancer because we might have a different cure potentially in decades away from now.
I mean, is that not exactly what they're doing with things like COVID? Like, we can't do therapeutics because we've got this vaccine. I mean, it's just the cognitive dissonance boggles the mind. And it's stuff like that happens in California all the time. It's absolutely fascinating. They'd rather spend, I think it's something like, you know, $330,000 to house a homeless person rather than this guy doing a great thing and making houses for them. It makes no sense.
So here is one of my favorite Emma Goldman quotes. I know you're a Emma Goldman fan. She says, "You will not find a single American who has not or who does not fancy at least he has something to gain or lose in his ambition, his social life, or business from the good opinion and the votes of those around him. Today, as then, public opinion is the omnipresent tyrant." She finishes by saying, "In America, struggle for liberty, in the American struggle for liberty, the majority was no less of a stumbling block than previous tyrants in history." Do you have any idea on how we can address Emma Goldman's issue of changing public opinion from the state being legitimate to voluntarism being the way to achieve your ends?
You know, I don't necessarily have an idea. A one-size-fits-all idea. I do know what has worked for me in convincing people. I do know things that I've seen that is red-pilling certain people. I know that one thing that is getting to a lot of people in my area specifically is a school issue. Lots of issues in San Francisco School Board that have been somewhat in the national news, but especially, you know, COVID school closures, things like that. That is getting, and you know, a lot of, you know, the worst people in the world, aka liberal white women, are getting red pilled because of things like this. Again, not a one size fits all approach, but I do know, for example, for me, I think, as I said earlier, I don't know if we were recording when I said this or if this was the first thing I said when we were recording, that speaking to people without defining or putting labels on yourself and or what you're trying to do, that has been something that's really worked for me. One of the things that I was able to kind of red pill people on taxes and how our taxes are used was saying, you know, imagine if you could pick where your taxes went. For example, something that I think I would like my tax money to go to if taxes are inevitable, is clearing the rape kit backlog. I'd rather they not go to pick something, housing a homeless person. I don't really mind that. I mean, if I was voluntarily picking it, obviously, you know, the various energy initiatives that I usually think are stupid and turns out are actually causing the forest fires, things like that. I don't want to contribute to that. I want my money to go to this. That is something that I've had, you know, young liberal white women look at me and be like, wow, that is truly progress. And I'm like, you know, again, like you would not say that if you knew what angle I was coming at this from. But just actually talking to people about the meat and potatoes of the issues rather than saying, you know, as a libertarian, as a this, as of that, this is what we believe in. I'm talking about me and you. Here's what I think. What do you think? You know, and what's your argument against this? And if you got one, I'm thrilled to listen to it because I've heard it all before.
One of the ones that I would use, I would talk to a lot of progressives at my previous job. Now I'm around a lot more conservatives, but this was around Trump's administration. And I would ask people if they support separating parents from their children, if parents don't chip in for certain things that the state would like them to, which is what happens if you don't pay taxes, the state will separate you from your child. If you don't send them to a certain school, like right. If it has to be either their schools or a licensed school, which I right. mean, if the Catholic Church did this, we'd be like, okay, obvious scam. They're trying to get their ideas pushed out by right. everyone and they want to control the funding. Clearly, that's a joke. But when it comes to the state doing it, the Koch brothers, well, they're self-interested. Everyone's self-interested except right. this kind group of people called government. That is unbelievable. Do you have any other elevator pitches, any other one-liners that you have seen really plant the seed of getting people to think freely?
You know, I think one thing too that a lot of people in California, and this is why I think reading Emma Goldman is really important for all libertarians, even though most of my type of libertarian would be more to the right end of the spectrum. I believe, regardless of her leftism, I think she's a fascinating read and conveys the ideas of anarchism in a way that is just like just brilliant. One of the things that I think that she conveys so well is the idea of the majority, the mass being essentially parasitic, whereas the individual, like, I guess you'd say to people, you know, you've been in charge, your group of people has been in charge for a long time. Well, imagine if it was different. Do you want Republicans ruling over you? Do you want those evil Nazis ruling over you and telling you what to do? Do you consent to what they want you to do? No, you wouldn't. You think they're ignorant and stupid. You think you're smarter than them. Well, you probably are as an individual in ruling over your own life than the masses are. So why let these people, just by the fact that they got 51% of the vote, why are you consenting to them ruling over you? You know, we do always say, like, as a joke, like, democracy's, you know, the way you pick where you're going to dinner tonight with a group of friends. It's not how you should be living your life.
Yeah. When I think of Emma Goldman's shortcomings, it's like she was so good. And then she'll say something like, by the very fact of his being, free access to land and all means of production and entire liberty of disposing of the fruits of his efforts. Free access to land and all the means of production. It's like she takes the concept of people being free to do what they want that doesn't aggress against anyone. You and know, now all of a sudden you have an entitlement to things that only come about as the result of someone else's labor, which would be the means of production.
She said something that made me think that if she had been around later, she probably would not have identified herself as socialist. She was talking about the very fact that the state exists and that it uses as the justification for his authority, the consent of the masses, that that would still continue basically in, you know, good socialism, because what did she say? Jesus, she said the same things that allow that to happen would happen in socialism. And she essentially says, how long would any of this last without the willingness of the mass to become soldiers, policemen, jailers, and hangmen of the state? And she essentially is basically saying at some point, this is going to keep happening as long as you're willing to go with whatever is comfortable, or the mass is willing to go with what's ever comfortable. And, you know, I think if she was around today, she might realize that, you know, socialism in general, private property in general, although she did have an interesting thing about private property in here that I highlighted, but whatever, was not the way to go. But, you know, she's a product of her time, as we all are.
Yeah, it's like you even see it in the first passage we discuss, where the socialists might say it's the bosses versus the people and the people should have the power. But if the people are just as ignorant as any boss or tyrant, well, then maybe I would prefer to have an employer who's reasonable than always be, you know, subject to the mass of voters. I mean, they could be right, they could be wrong, but that's the importance of competition, which only a free market would allow. Everywhere else, there has to be a vote. Oh, can we please just let people specialize and trade freely?
Well, and I think one of the things too, and actually this kind of goes to what we were talking about with communicating the message to people who are not already on our side. One of the things that turned me, my journey from minarchist to anarchist was about 3 days rather than 3 months, because I read Emma Goldman at the suggestion of a friend who I made on Twitter, who was in Antifa. he said, read Emma Goldman. So I read, and she said something in one of her essays. I don't recall if it was the general one on anarchism. I thought it was the one about political violence. It might've been in both. She said something to the effect of, you know, the whole thing about anarchism that the status quo is trying to keep us in is they say it's destruction and violence. And basically she says, we're the ones working against destruction and violence. Where do you see destruction and violence today with the arms of the state? You say to people, you don't like police brutality. Guess what? They have no accountability. Private security, they could be fired. They could face consequences. You don't use them anymore. You have no choice to disassociate from your police force in your town if they're not doing the right thing. Whereas, let's say we all decided we wanted to use XYZ security force. They are really bad. We say, you know what? We're terminating our contract and we're going to go hire elsewhere. You can do that in a free stateless society. You can't do that right now. You're handcuffed to these people. So let's see, like, that red pills people a little bit. When you start to work with them on the issues that you know matter to them, that gets them.
Isn't that funny? Where it's like, they will say, we're here to serve you. Your representatives represent you. The cops are here to serve you. Can we opt out of funding you? I really didn't like that Eric Garner footage. I didn't really like the Tony Tempa or Kelly Thomas or Daniel Schaefer footage. I think you guys are getting a little uppity. You've been enforcing this drug war for, 50 years since Nixon? I think I'm going to go elsewhere. No, you can't go elsewhere. Yeah. If you try and go elsewhere, you're the criminal that we tell you we're protecting you from. Well,
and I'm not against collective bargaining.
To speak to a manager immediately.
Right. I need to speak to a manager. I'm not against collective bargaining per se, as long as, again, it's voluntary. I'm against the way that state unions do it. But again, these are the reason, one of the biggest reasons people always get outraged when these cops are suspended with pay. You know why they're suspended with pay? Because the police union, that's a union thing. That's not the police. That's not the police department. That's a union thing. And I just think it's funny that these are the things that most progressives stomp the hardest for, is unions. And, you know, against police brutality, yet the things that they do perpetuate that cycle, you know, more than they know.
Could that be a different angle where we sort of merge the two? We take the atrocity committed and then your, you know, acquiescence or your support. So we say, really, you think that I should be forced to fund You think Eric Garner's family should be forced to fund the police station that murdered their son?
Yeah.
Really? Their father? Really, you think that? Now, it applies to every other atrocity that the state has committed.
Sure.
But the reason you use that is because that one's on camera, and it's so bad that it really tugs at their heartstrings, like Waco does at mine.
The Eric Garner one is one of the ones that really, like, red-pilled me, because you just think of what that guy was harassed for. Loose cigarettes. And by the way, he's in New York, where I think cigarettes are taxed like well over the price of the pack itself. And you just think about, and that ended up with him dying. And it's just like, you know, you always get the people who say like, oh, he was killed for a tail light. And you find out, yeah, he had just robbed a bank and they were serving a lawful warrant. You know, I don't love that either. But Eric Garner, that's one that just really, it's a great one to use as an example for people, because there's not a lot of ways you can argue that that guy deserved what happened to him.
And the cop didn't break the law. Or in the case of Daniel Schaefer, cop didn't break the law. Ugh. Tony Timpa, did you see the Kelly Thomas security footage?
No.
I have a hard time watching those videos.
Oh,
don't bother. That one I will say. I still got to send you the Elvis Summers homeless.
Oh, video. I have to. I'm really interested in that.
That's productive. The point is sometimes you can just see that not only is it so evil, it's not against their rules. And so long as we have this double standard, this moral double standard for government called statism, any brand of this thing is doomed to fail. We're not the utopians. You guys are the utopians. But are there any final Emma Goldman contributions that you'd like to make the audience aware of?
You know, I don't think so. I think that we've covered her pretty well. I think most people do know that she's, you know, great, the godmother of anarchism. I would just say again that for some reason, those two words together, the way she did it with like an exclamation point. She just said destruction and violence. And it was like, I could hear her like exasperation at saying that as it goes to anarchism, and just thinking like, wow, she's really right. Like, do I look around today where we have the opposite of anarchism and not see destruction and violence everywhere? No, I don't. So I really think of that, reading that sentence as being the turning point where I went from minarchist, night watchman state to anarchist. And again, like, I know we were going to talk about this a little bit with law, but one of the reasons that I didn't go straight to anarchist was because I said, I just don't understand how it's going to go with the courts, which I work with, and the police to a lesser extent, but the courts is really the hard one. And that's what it just sort of took me a minute. But then reading her, I was just like, you know what? We can figure it out, because she's so right about everything else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, could you imagine if anarchists started two world wars within like 20 years of each other? Because that's exactly what we would expect by the statist point of view. Anarchists are constantly going to war, but then governments step in and they're the ones who bring peace. No, it's governments going to war, lying, saying the Germans are putting or the Iraqis are putting babies in incubators. The Germans are putting babies on bayonets. They're the ones lying us into the violent conflict, not the other way around, ever.
It's the classic example of, you know, breaking your leg and then giving you the crutch, and they get to take all the credit. You know, we all met in so-and-so and we like, you know, negotiated some treaty. It's like for the treaty of the thing that you started unjustly for no reason. Great. I'm glad you solved your own problem. Why did you have to involve the rest of us? And again, I would like to see a receipt, an itemized invoice telling me exactly how much my direct tax dollars contributed to Afghanistan. I would love to know that one day, because I object. I've always objected. So, but they can't do that.
For all those civilians killed, the Taliban better not take over in 11 days. After a 20-year war. I hope things are going well there.
The Taliban are my people. I'm going to probably lose a lot of popular support by saying that, but I was good friends on Twitter with Milan Coste, who was the meme lord of the Taliban. He was hilarious. I miss him every day.
Yeah, I'm sure now that we spent trillions of dollars there, the women are listening to Cyndi Lauper and watching Carrie Bradshaw's shoe collection.
For the women, man. As a woman, I don't like it. I wouldn't like to live like that. But I'm sorry. This is not my problem.
There is a book called Egalitarianism as Revolt Against Nature and Other Essays by Murray Rothbard, something else that motivated you to become a voluntarist. On page 10, Rothbard says, since egalitarians begin with the a priori axiom that all people and hence all groups of people are uniform and equal, it then follows for them that any and all group differences in status, prestige, or authority in society must be the result of unjust oppression and irrational discrimination. What are the big takeaways from egalitarianism as revolt against nature?
So for me, I think that that was, reading that essay in particular, was a huge, I mean, it was really just putting the ways that I had, the things that I had been thinking about in my head for so long, putting it into an essay that I was just like, wow, he showed the logical flow is great. Everything he says is legit. And it really helps me. Because one thing I've always felt sort of guilty about is being someone who advocates for certain things in a position of, not to use a left language, of relative privilege, though I've, you know, grown up in a fortunate to be in, you know, a two-parent household, parents who worked very hard, although they came from nothing, who, you know, helped me achieve what I've achieved in my life. And the idea that there's a lot of people who would dismiss what I have to say because of those factors. And I always thought that, you know, this idea of equality and equity were hard things to get past. And when you just hear Rothbard essentially say, we take the idea of equality as a good without anyone ever proving to us that it was a good thing, was just like, oh my God, wow, that is true. Like, why is equality a good thing? And I always, like, now when I explain to people, Michael Malice has that thing where he says, you know, are all people, or some people better than others? And person on the right will say yes or no. A person on the left gives you a speech. The example I always use for something like that is LeBron James. He's an amazing athlete. He's also really good at acting. I don't know if you saw him in that train wreck movie with Amy Schumer. He's hilarious. He's better than me. He's better. You know what I'm saying? He makes a lot of money because of that. The idea that, you know, some really terrible person is just as good as LeBron James, not true. The idea that people, you know, the idea that people should be treated equally has always been this ideal that's been held up as essentially a positive ideal rather than what, if you're really going to use it, should be a negative ideal, as in we should not erect, you know, institutions, systems, et cetera, that prevent people from being treated equally, which essentially would get us to free market anarchism. But yeah, I just remember that essay finally being a way to explain the morality of, or immorality of, equality as a primary goal. And the fact that the left has had the moral high ground forever because of that, when you really think about it, how it is immoral. I think he goes into the example of making people's faces all equally beautiful. So you're going to have plastic surgery to make ugly people better looking, but you also have to get the pretty people down to that level too. And nobody would be okay with that, the downward trend. Everyone wants to come up, but no one would really be okay with forcing people to come down. And that's essentially what equity, equality, what it's really going to achieve, taken to its logical conclusion.
I think also, people don't understand the benefits of trade. So even though I might look at Chris Rock and say, this bastard talks into a microphone and makes tons of money, and it's so famous, he could get any woman he wants, he could live anywhere he wants, he could travel anytime he wants, and here I am, you know, let's say my previous job, I was working in 0-degree weather in the Walmart freezer a few years ago. And I was making, let's just say, less than Chris Rock. A little bit less than
little,
Chris Rock.
At
the time. I think it's, one, that allowing Chris Rock to be so good brings so much joy to so many people. Because they can buy his products and services and laugh and reap benefits from him.
Absolutely.
And there's the moral aspect of, no one owes me an audience. No one owes me any of their time, money, labor. And once I realize I'm not entitled to anything, everything people give me is a voluntary gift that I also need to create value in exchange for, well, then it's not Chris Rock is this evil bastard exploiting me and, you know, any CEO is also exploiting me. It's, well, how do I become as good as them? What can I do to be that good? And when it comes to, I mean, you mentioned privilege, there is something about where you're born in life does either give you a leg up or a leg down. But when the progressive has used it, it's always been a tool of division. It's the equivalent of me saying, you know, Black Americans need to recognize their privilege because they could be Black Haitians or Black Nigerians. So right. They need to recognize that. It's like, well, look, it's terrible to be any of them, and it's good that they're in America, but please don't use that unnecessary division. Or I could say American Asians who have higher incomes than whites, or I'm half Jewish, half white, but they have higher incomes than me. They have privilege and they need to address that. And the Japanese people have privilege because they have, that's so evil and divisive. So right. I like the way you didn't use it as a divisive mechanism. It's just something, hey, I was born in a first world country with two parents, and that's that's beneficial. Anything on any of that stuff I said, or egalitarianism and Murray Rothbard?
Well, I think I love that you used the Chris Rock example, because I was thinking about that earlier, and just the fact that if we're even going to go into like the sports realm, but actually before I go into sports, the thing about Chris Rock and someone like him is that there was a long period of time where he would have been doing that for free, for no value. But at some point it's created value. And I think people need to realize, you know, that yes, now he's making tons of money, but there were years where he was doing that for nothing. He was paying the clubs to put him on because you have to buy two drinks or whatever. So, but with sports, for example, they make so much money because they're doing something that not a lot of people can do. And people are willing to pay that. You are getting what people are willing to pay you. You know what I'm saying? I don't get paid as a lawyer. People think, oh, you make a lot of money, but I don't get paid as much as Chris Rock, for example, because I don't create the value to as large of a group of people as he does. So I think that people really need to understand that as well when they go into, you know, this exploitation of the worker and all of that. It's like, what value are you really creating? The thing you create, you know, assuming that we didn't have computers and all of that helping a lot now, the thing you create, yeah, you just created, you know, the widget of XYZ value. And you want to get paid a certain amount of value, but think about the actual value of the widget you created versus the sacrifices of the person at the top. You know, I don't love when a CEO makes $300 billion and his workers make, you know, 30 grand. I think that's, I don't love that just because of the optics of it all. But then when you really break it down, you know, sometimes it makes sense with the values. And I think people just like to spout off without actually ever going and doing the homework and the breakdown of the numbers. And who has time for that? I know I don't, so I get it. But I'm just saying people like to think way too simply when we talk about exchanges of value and the equality of what people bring into the world and what they should have.
One of my favorite quotes in this book is in the final essay. Rothbard says, "If men were like ants, there would be no interest in human freedom. If individual men like ants were uniform, interchangeable, devoid of specific personality traits of their own, then who would care whether they were free or not?" What is the reason that you are so passionate about human freedom?
I think, I mean, that is a great point. And leftists love to talk about diversity, but they never think about the fact that one of the great things about the fact that we're not all equal is that it actually means we are very diverse. Each of us, you and I are both white. I guess you're half Jewish. You know, you're white, I'm white. We're incredibly diverse from each other. And the one size fits all approach, not great. This is part of the reason that I'm very interested in the idea of, you know, private conflict resolution and things of that nature, is because one size fits all or one size fits most doesn't really fit all. It doesn't really fit most. And you're sacrificing something somewhere that is important. And again, you know, the freedom of people to do what they want to do yields great things such as innovation and otherwise, and creating great value. I can't tell you all the time that that freedom is just going to come from stateless society. Yes, sometimes that freedom does come from money or a leg up here or there. But again, it does. It's one of the most important things, because the diversity of each individual human means that certain things are coercive to someone and they aren't to others. And consent is the most important. And I might not consent to something that you would, and vice versa. And that's fine. But the idea that we're coerced into doing the same thing, I'm coerced into something that you would readily consent to, is not okay in my book.
How can libertarianism improve the legal system?
Well, so it's actually very interesting. In my area of law, I practice family law. That's divorce, domestic violence, child custody, things of that sort. We actually do use private judges to a degree. In California, private judges are either lawyers who have done a certain something to be able to qualify as a private judge, or retired judge who now agrees to hear your case. Quite expensive, because again, you're offering a scarce service. I do think that that one day would certainly go down in cost if it was the only option. But one of the biggest issues, and especially in my area of law, is some of these things require immediate action. And the courts, the state courts, you're not getting in there immediately. A lot of times we're going in there, we're getting a solution, but we also have to do corrective work too, because 2 months have just gone by since I asked a court to rule on this issue. And things might have gotten better, things might have gotten worse. The court has, 10 minutes to hear your case unless you want to go to trial. They've read over your papers. I can't tell you how many times someone has given me the facts of their case and, written it down for me, and it's 30 pages. And I say, hey, the court's not going to read that. I got to cut this down to 10, and they probably won't even read all 10 either. So the great thing about private judges is that they can spend as much time as they want. They can really learn about you, your case, the facts of it. And the facts is really what matters more than the actual law itself, in my opinion. Especially if we were going to go the libertarian route and basically say, in the law system that I would subscribe to would be, we'd start with the non-aggression principle. Okay. What really matters then is the facts of your case, and not, I can't tell you how many times I've been in court fighting over the meaning of a word mm-hmm. in the statute. And I love doing that because I am semi-autistic, but I'm saying it's not helpful to my client. It's fun for me. The end result is helpful for my client. The amount of time that I had to do that is actually unfair if you really think about it, because, it's because whoever made the law messed up. So I do think that people need to realize how important it is to be able to go into a dispute resolution process where you know that the person deciding your fate with something as important as your children or what have you really knows all of the facts that are important to you, important to the other person, and can decide your case based on the facts of your family as presented to them, rather than some arbitrary principle that was, put into law whenever ago. One thing in California we have is our domestic violence, our family law domestic violence statute is incredibly broad. It covers physical violence, threats of physical violence, sexual violence, and then it refers you to another statute that details some maybe 21, 22 different kinds of behaviors that probably have sub-behaviors too, including things like text messaging someone too much after they've told you to stop. You can get a domestic violence finding against you for something like that. The reason that statute has not been shrunk is because nobody wants to be the one going and saying, hey, I think our domestic violence statute needs to be stricter, because then someone comes to you and says, oh, you don't care about victims. And it's this whole thing. So I think that it's important that we don't make people slaves to these arbitrary rules that have disastrous consequences to the people involved. I mean, everyone who wants to talk about, a lot of people love on the right or wherever love to talk about Black fatherlessness. Well, nobody likes to talk about the fact that a good portion of the reason that there's so many fatherless homes in the Black community is because they're in jail. High rates of incarceration. They're not there to provide for the children, provide child support, provide emotional support and whatever because of these arbitrary rules that this guy fell into. So I think, you know, the domestic violence statute has the potential to do that in California. It makes people prone to losing their jobs, having difficulties getting hired, not supporting their children, making people relying on the state thereafter. And it's a whole cycle that wouldn't exist if we can make things private to whatever degree it can be done. I'm not necessarily smart enough to design the whole system myself, but I think that that does get us on the right track because I've seen how much better and fairer, even to the person who's losing when it comes from a private judge, because you know that they thoroughly were involved in your case rather than this is the 60th case I heard today. They barely remembered your name and all of that.
Well, yeah, you don't have all the answers. Neither does any statist or conservative right. or progressive. So that's nothing to be ashamed of on our end. Kevin Castley and I debated. I don't know if you know who that is. If you don't, you're a wealthier woman for having not knowing him. he had said, well, my father was a drug addict, so you don't know how terrible it is. Drugs need to be illegal. And I said, actually, my dad was a drug addict, and he's very public about this. And you know what? I will be fair to you. It was terrible that his drug addiction negatively affected us. The only thing that would have been worse is if he had ever gotten caught using crack. It wasn't like marijuana or anything, because then he'd be in jail and I wouldn't have a dad. And then he never would have given my mom child support. And then when he got out of jail, he would have had so many connections to jail. He would have gone back to jail and he would have gotten addicted to more drugs in jail, but he never would have been able to get a solid job coming out of jail. So that would have made things even worse. So as bad as things are, as bad as Russia invading Ukraine is, don't intervene. As bad as my dad being a drug addict is, please don't use your coercion to intervene further. It's better to do nothing than to do something bad or try doing something productive if that's in your capacity.
Absolutely. And prison, I was just talking to a lawyer from Utah when I went to a fundraiser for Angela McCardle in Vegas. I was talking to this lawyer from Utah and I told him I did family law and he's like, he goes, oh my God, I'd rather do 400 murders than do one divorce case. And we were laughing about that. But I was telling him, you know, he does, well, it's a criminal defense now. And he was saying, I was saying, you know what the craziest thing is that prisons create hardened criminals. Mm. That people go in for being a drug addict or doing whatever, and they come out, maybe they killed someone in prison. Maybe, you know, they got involved in the drug trade in prison because they were scared of whoever was going to beat them up. You know, prison, of course, there's always going to be people that need to be kept away from society, rapists, you know, child molesters, et cetera. But prison does innumerably more damage than it does good to society, especially to these people who are the most vulnerable. And the idea that people can't see that is just stupid. And again, that's the benefit of the one size all situation, mandatory minimums, things like these that don't make sense within the facts of somebody's life and case, which might not have been fully communicated to the judge because, again, it's state court. They don't have time and, you know, they do what they do, the bare minimum.
Oh, yeah. Government will always give us shortages. That was one of the great things that I thought Adam Kokesh originally brought to the freedom movement, where he would ask people face to face. He goes, you believe in putting someone in a cage and shooting them if they resist for not abiding by some trivial regulation or not chipping in via taxation for whatever nonsense, even if it's good? So what? If I'm really feeding the homeless, I don't have the right to go around threatening to cage people who don't give me money to feed the homeless. So just making that so clear to people that this is literally what they're advocating. They have no problem doing it with us. If you even question Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, you want people to die. You are a murderer. You're an accessory to murder at the very least. You're maybe you're not Ted Bundy, but you're like handing Ted Bundy the knives. That's how bad you are in their minds. I like the idea of you arguing for hours over the meaning of a word because as bad as that is,
I love it.
It's just proof. It's just proof that we need competition in the legal system. And for any criticism of competition, well, what if there's corruption? you get corruption under monopolies more than under competition. Well, what if someone's like really dumb and what if someone like doesn't care about the law and they're greedy, or what if someone's a bad person? All that applies more so to the state than it does.
And at least you get to choose your corruption when you're when there's competition. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. What is the best part of being a lawyer?
Again, for me, I do enjoy actually arguing for hours over the meaning of a word, even though it's not the most productive thing in the world. Learning a lot about people and different types of people in the world. I mean, I think for me, law school, the first time I really came alive in law school was when I started getting past just, you know, the real basic stuff about the reasoning behind, you know, civil procedure and the need for rules about service and stuff, and really started to get into examples and cases that apply to regular life. Community property, family law was one of the first things that really appealed to me because of that, because I was like, wow, I went to school with a lot of kids with divorced parents, and they were probably dealing with something like this. This is crazy. You can see, and I remember the first time in contracts class that they piqued my interest was when they were talking about the term unconscionability, unconscionable terms in a contract, and she related it to cell phone contracts. And I was like, oh my God, that's so funny. Cause you could think, when nobody ever reads the fine print, but you see in the fine print, if you actually read it, like, oh wow, that's crazy. But that, I think learning about real life and how these things affect real people, real life, and learning about the facts of what's going on in people's personal lives is fascinating. I don't have a dramatic personal life, so living vicariously through these people and their drama can be somewhat entertaining. It can also break your heart. But it also is very gratifying when you've helped someone, especially when you know you've helped their child too. That is also really great. But yeah, I mean, that guy who said he'd rather do 400 murders and one divorce, he was onto something. He was definitely onto something. That's why I'm actually trying to get more into just doing appellate work, because that does give me more of an opportunity to just do the law rather than focusing on the clients and their petty nonsense, because it's a divorce, there's going to be petty nonsense, and it is draining it sometimes, you know, fighting over pots and pans and the like, although that's rare, it's still draining. But yeah, it's really gratifying to know when you've helped somebody.
What's the worst part?
Who really needed it.
Sorry. What is the worst part of being a lawyer?
Well, dealing with the state is not great. Dealing with, you know, the courts and the judges, there's very, very minimal recourse. This is a great point also for the need for private judges. Very little recourse for getting rid of a judge that you know is biased against you or your client. You can challenge a judge as soon as they're assigned to you, but sometimes I get clients whose case has been going on for years and they've switched lawyers and come to me. I don't have a chance to challenge their judge. If this was happening with a private judge, you would have that opportunity. And the reason it's so hard to challenge a judge for cause is because everybody would be doing it. And the state's just like, we don't have time. Everyone would be doing it. No one's happy with their judge. That's the kind of thing that's like, well, wouldn't it be great if it wasn't a government-run thing and it wasn't only one of you? We could do things like this. You could fire somebody. You know, that is one of the most frustrating things, is because, you know, judges are not immune from bias. They can control it however way they see fit, but they're not immune from it. And they remember you. And I'm a little bit memorable in the courtroom. And I remember I know some judges who don't like me. And it's frustrating to have to go before them. And then also just, you know, dealing with real people and real problems can be frustrating, because I'm not them and I can't make them do what I would do in that situation. You know, and real humans are fallible and messy, and they mess up all the time. They lie to you all the time. Their interpretations of things are, you know, not always factual, and it could cause a little bit of an annoyance. But yeah, I guess those would be the most annoying things. But that judge one is really aggravating. And also just, you know, the amount of time between getting things done is very slow.
Well, I think dealing with the state in person will sort of demystify it. So whereas we always sort of have this separate category of, well, if we have private security, only some people will get it. Whereas if the public has it, then everyone gets it. it took me getting mugged in downtown. This would have been Phoenix, Broadway and Price Road in Arizona, to where the cops were so uninterested in the fact that my friend and I just got held up. What they were really interested in is whether or not I was smoking weed in the car at the time.
Of course.
What were you doing in that area? And I said, you know what? My friend and I were, we had pulled in. We had 20 minutes to kill before I dropped him off at night school. We were eating Burger King. He goes, you mind if I search the car? And I go, what are you? This guy is not exactly Bill Gates. He's not totally rich. And his laptop just got stolen. That's pretty convenient. Can we look at that? He goes, why don't you and I drive around? I said, can I have my license back? He goes, I'm going to hold on to it. And like just this weaselly entitled, let me exhale as I give you my answer. Just so manipulative and ridiculous. Right. And then I come back and I go, and they said, these guys sitting near the place where we were, they said, hey man, what's going on? And I said, they were just driving me around trying to see if we could find the guy who robbed us. And they go, oh, we were just curious because they had a bunch of dogs circling your car for like 30 minutes. And I go, okay, Frederick Bastiat, Lysander Spooner, I'm a voluntarist. That's right. I'm throwing in the towel. I can't take small state anymore.
I think there's just, and I haven't read the full article, so forgive me if I get any facts wrong, but I just saw this headline. A woman in Oakland was getting home invaded, shot warning shots in the air. Yes, warning shots are not ideal. They can endanger other people. However, she's being investigated now by the cops, even though she was the victim of an attempted home invasion. And, you know, from my experience with the cops in Oakland, I would not be surprised if they just say, probably not going to catch him. We don't really have a description. So let's catch you. When I got my car broken into in San Francisco, I called I don't have time to go into why I had that much valuable stuff in my car, but they stole all of it. The police officer on the call was just like, and what do you want me to do about that? And I was like,
wow,
could you find my stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, it's probably, you know, they probably threw in a dumpster, it's pawned or whatever. And I'm like, but are you going to see if you could find it? And I feel like she said no, honestly, but I don't quite remember because I was so traumatized. But I was like, bitch, I'm the victim here. And like, you're giving me attitude. But they're just like, you know, what's the easiest thing for us to do right now? Sit on our fat asses and we'll go after you rather than the guy who tried to take you, because that would actually take some effort. Imagine if they got paid more or got a bonus or something, if they caught the guy who robbed you. Where could that happen? In a private police force, something like that. But, you know, hey.
Exactly. My aunt got robbed in New York City and she found a cop and said, my pearl necklace was just stolen. And the cop said, join the club So look, I'm not saying, well, under private security, everything's perfect.
Of course.
Nothing is ever perfect. But at least we can freaking opt out of associating with bad actors. That's all I'm ever saying when it comes to these discussions.
Which and the power of choice is always an important one there. Again, you know, the power to choose your corruption, essentially, as I said, you know, that is people like choices.
Which of your previous cases have you been most passionate about?
Oh, God. I do tend to get pretty passionate about cases of domestic violence, legitimate cases of domestic violence. Like I said, you know, I don't want to minimize anything anyone's gone through. Things can be traumatic to different people. People aren't one size fits all. But cases of real, you know, when you know that someone has been legitimately beaten, their life threatened, you know, inability to do anything, move on with their life. The child they are now using the child to perpetrate the abuse on the person. Those types of cases I'm very passionate about those. And to be honest, those are probably the ones where I do find the most difficulty trying to think about how I would apply private law enforcement or private court enforcement onto those cases, because sometimes you need a restraining order and you need it right now. and you need someone who is going to, you know, has to enforce that. That's one of the most difficult areas, problems that I've not figured out how to solve yet. I also, I mean, if you really want to know, there's this one crazy case I have that's all about property. And it's all about the issue of something called transmutation. California is a community property state. Everything acquired during marriage is presumed to be community property unless you can show that it meets certain statutory exemptions, essentially in layman's terms. This one of the exemptions is if you use private, or if you use separate property to acquire it. And then there's this idea that something can be transmuted. I can agree to make it community property, or I can agree to make community property separate property. I did this with this $4 million house, won the case. It was a big thing, but it was really fun. I don't know. I like numbers and property and stuff like that because it's less emotional. But there is like a little bit of like a justice element to it where you can be like, yeah, that bitch was trying to get your money and I saved it from her. So that can be fun. But yeah, the domestic violence ones are probably across the board the ones I am most passionate about.
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, you don't have the solution for restraining orders. At what distance? At what time? For what reason? Does this person fall under this category? Right. At what point is it abuse? Patting someone on the back once, 1,000 times? How hard? Until it's so vague that you need competition. So,
although I will say, the fact that having people have guns is helpful. This is my restraining order.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I fake gun. Sure. Yeah, but yeah. No, you're right. I mean, again, and patting someone on the back can be very threatening in a certain context if, you know, but it can also just be patting someone on the back.
Exactly. Well, Cernovich used the case of at what point is it brandishing, as in threatening someone with a gun? Mm-hmm. Is it pulling out a gun, showing you have it loaded? Well, if it's to a friend, no. Well, what if you're in a bank and you just tap it and push against your clothes to show that the outline of the gun? Well, that's brandishing, certainly. Because why are you doing that inside of a bank? Right. You're going in to withdraw money from. So because it's so complex is why we need freedom. What are some of the biggest misconceptions about the legal system?
I would say, and this is probably going to piss off a lot of people, I would say the idea that fathers are treated disproportionately bad. I have not seen that in my, but this could be a function of the fact that I practice in California and gender neutrality is explicitly codified in our statutes. But California is very egalitarian in the way it approaches families. And I've seen many a great father have great success over a crap mother lots of times. The case where I was just talking about the transmutation of property case, that was me saving $4 million for a dude, you know. So it's not always, she's not always getting half your stuff. But I just wanted to throw that out there just because I know a lot of men love to complain about that. It's not always, it's a little bit blown out of proportion, I think, and it might be a relic of older times. I could be completely wrong if I don't know for a fact that all of the states are maybe as egalitarian as we are here. But I know in California, for example, there has been child psychologists expressly writing articles about the importance of fathers for children, the unique importance of fathers. So I don't think you're at as big of a disadvantage as you think you are all the time. But another misconception about the court system, I guess, would be that it's completely impossible to get around some of these statutes. Most statutes do have some sort of catch-all provision, exception to the rule type thing. And a lot of times we'll say, you know, we can do this, that, the other thing. If there's a showing made of this thing for good cause, and if there's good reason to deviate from the mandatory thing in the law. And I do think that's the benefit of having a good lawyer is that lawyer knows essentially the shorthand way to get you to become the exception to a certain thing. There's always going to be a way to do it. And that is one of the better things about the law. Is that it allows for those things. And I guess, I can't think of anything else that's the misconception. I think most people have dealt with courts to some degree in their lives. And I think that most people have a pretty good idea of what's going on. I just thought of something though, is that, and it's not relevant to what you just asked. You reminded me though, when I was in law school, my second year, I taught an after school program to juvenile gang members and other juvenile offenders. Most of them were in gangs. I don't believe it was explicit to gangs, but most of them were in some, either the Mexican mafia or the Norteños. I don't remember their official name. And I remember teaching them a class about use of force and cops, and having the way that we were taught how to explain to them was steps. So if you're on this step, meaning you use your fist, they're allowed to go one step above you and use their baton. If you use a baton, they're allowed to go to the gun. And essentially saying like, why is that okay? And me just saying, sitting there like, because they're the cops. That's why it's okay. I have no actual reason. It's just why. It's just, that's why. That's the justification. And that was a little bit of a wake up call. But yeah, that just
government supremacy. I mean, finally, a supremacy that's actually real.
I mean, imagine, for example, if you were, I know there's, you know, there's a lot of factual things about the Breonna Taylor case that are misunderstood by a lot of people. But imagine if you had a private law enforcement who went in and, yeah, it was an accident, accidentally killed the wrong person. Or the case that just happened recently, I came blanking on the kid's name. They killed someone. Yes, it was an accident. They didn't mean to do that. There should be a method of restitution of something. You should be able to get fired from your job. And again, they don't get to do that because, hey, he was acting within his capacity as a police officer, and he automatically gets a step up on an average citizen for things that we're not allowed to do. He's allowed to do, you know, one degree higher. And it's just, it's ridiculous. And for no other reason than he is a cop.
Exactly. What happens if I kill a cop on accident? Well, look, it's bad. But I mean, calling it an accident, I shouldn't have been doing it in the first place.
I don't know if you remember those two guys who escaped from prison in New York back in like 2015. And they just like, they were on the run for like 30 days. One of the guys was like a serial rapist, murderer, whatever. And he was in there for 30 years. The other guy was one murder, and it was of a police officer. During a robbery, they ran over him. He was in there for life without parole. It was so interesting because this guy had a heinous rap sheet, but he was like, had the possibility of the parole. The one who killed the cop when I believe he was 19, no possibility of parole. And it's like, oh, so you, I mean, you're expressly stating that a law enforcement life is more valuable than mine or yours or anybody else's.
Exactly. I do like the point you made about fathers not necessarily being discriminated against, because I mean, the second I saw that in the what's it called, Cassie J's movie, The Red Pill or something like that, where she had said, you know, it's there is a disproportionate amount of men who don't get custody compared to women. I go, look, I've been in the equality game for a while. That tells me nothing. It doesn't tell me how many fathers fought and wanted the kid, how many took the deal of giving full custody in exchange for not paying child support. It doesn't tell me how many fathers even showed up to court and said, I really want custody. I really want this obligation. Doesn't tell me how many mothers know who the father is. That tells me literally nothing. It's literally like saying Asians earn more than whites.
Right.
Discrimination. I know everything I need to know. Discrimination exists. Not necessarily.
No offense, men. I think that you are very important. Fathers are incredibly important. My own father was incredibly important. I mean, he's still alive, but growing up was incredibly important in my life. But I mean, look, a lot of men set themselves up for the situation by saying, I want you to stay home and take care of the kids, and I want to be the one earning. Well, when it comes to finally split, if you got to pick between one or the other for primary, let's say that's the situation. Let's say you don't automatically, you know, California, the goal, the public policy in California is that we should strive towards equal time with both parents. Let's say that that's not the law in your state. Well, you want primary custody. You're working. She's not. Why is it better for you to have it when she can actually be there and you would have to hire a babysitter or whatever? You know,
yeah.
It's not telling you the whole thing. And if you want your wife to stay at home and raise your children and cook and clean and all the stuff that a lot of men do want, you're setting yourself up in a divorce to not be the primary caregiver of your children. It kind of naturally, it logically flows to a degree. Again, though, I do want to stress that I think fathers are incredibly important. A good father can really change the outcome of a child's life. But I don't think the discrimination is as bad as they make it seem, even though I know there are plenty of terrible cases out there that would say the otherwise. Writ large, I don't think it's as bad as they would like to make it seem.
Sure, it's possible, but men are also 50% of the population and like 90% of inmates, or what, 95% of inmates?
Absolutely.
And look, men commit more violent crimes than women. And that's it's not because of, you know, it's not because Andrea Dworkin and the feminists have totally taken over. It is because, look, men's testosterone is the contributor
testosterone propensity to take a risk,
exactly,
et cetera. The things that make men great are also the things that can contribute to their downfall, just like with almost anything in life.
Exactly. Did you read The Myth of the Rule of Law by John Hasnes?
Don't think so.
So no. That is the last chapter in Malice's book, The Anarchist Handbook. He says there is something called the myth of the rule of law. He summarizes it here. He says, "This, however, in no way prevents people from simultaneously regarding the law as a body of definite, politically neutral rules amenable to an impartial application, which all citizens have a moral obligation to obey." He says, this is the myth. The concept that it's totally impartial, that there's your personal opinion, but you disregard that. Once you're in the judge's seat, you have the rule of law. This is what Amy Coney Barrett was really pushing in her acceptance speeches. Do you have any comment on the myth of the rule of law, or the idea that law can and should be something totally impartial that can be taken apart from each individual judge?
I don't think there's any possible way to make it completely impartial. I'd like to think that, and I do think the best judges out there are the ones who know they have a bias and can control for it. Because if you try to say, I'm free from bias, you're crazy.
Yes.
There was one judge up here, she's technically a commissioner, who stated in one of our programs, for example, she said, "I have a bias against homeschooling. I realized I had that bias. And I always thought if it was coming up that homeschooling was the wrong choice. Then I got a case where the facts made it so clear to me that homeschooling was the right choice. It totally changed my mind. And now every time I have one of those cases, I knew to tell myself, take your bias out of it and consider it from an equal standpoint." I know, for example, a judge I can think of right now who I've had cases in front of her where the facts seem very clear to me. But she found out things about the parties, for example, two cases in particular where the man had been unfaithful to the woman in a way that was worse than usual, in that it involved a bigger betrayal of trust, like as in it was with a friend or something. I could just see it on her face. I'm like, oh, she's been cheated on before. Like, and it was probably with her best friend or something like that. You could just tell. And she immediately became biased against my client, even though the facts really should have ruled things in his favor. We actually don't have a ruling on that case yet, so whatever. And I just don't think you can really ask people to be completely impartial when they've had experiences in life. But that's also one of the reasons that I think the facts of each case is so important, or are so important, and why they should be given greater attention in these cases, which is, again, allowed for in a private judge case. But I think that I don't believe I read that essay, but I did listen to something where essentially, I mean, the myth of the rule of law, it is a myth, because you and I could resolve a dispute without the intervention of the court. It happens all the time. You and I agree, and whatever you and I agree on might not be something that anybody else in the world would agree on, but you and I agree on it. We resolved our problem and we've moved on. There's not a universal There's no universality to what we just did. That's you and me. It's two people. And I do think in that sense, yeah, there is, it is a myth. And it's definitely a myth of impartiality, but people are better than others at remaining, or at least giving off the appearance of impartiality.
I love the example he uses because he starts off the essay with saying, take the following quiz. The First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom
read this,
of speech or press.
I listened to something about this. Yeah, I think I listened to continue.
Well, so he says, let's take the First Amendment. This is something so basic. Everyone's right. Heard of it. It's not some distant regulation right. From Montana in 1873. Let's talk about the most basic thing from the founding of America. What does it mean? In a time of war, a federal statute may be passed prohibiting citizens from revealing military secrets to the enemy. Is that a violation of the First Amendment? Some judges have said yes in the case of Bradley Manning. Now, is that speech or is that property rights? Well, if it's me sending you the file of the collateral murder video, which Bradley Manning did, well, that's a property rights issue. What if I just tell you? Well, that could be a speech issue. He says, second, the president may issue an executive order prohibiting public criticism of his administration. All of these, the Wilson administration in this case.
So, arguably, that's not a violation, but it is a violation of the principle, but arguably because it's not Congress. It's the president directing agencies on how to utilize their efforts. But still,
wouldn't that be a violation of the First Amendment?
Absolutely. But it just, it's not, by a plain language, it's not Congress making a law.
Yeah. Or a federal statute may be passed prohibiting a citizen from falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater.
I'd say that's a violation.
Congress may pass a law prohibiting dancing to rock and roll music. He says that that's a real case. I don't know which one exactly that
is. It's definitely possible. It's been a long time since I did con law. But
Congress may pass a statute prohibiting flag burning. Or no, he also uses the International Revenue Service may issue a regulation prohibiting the publication of a book explaining how to cheat on your taxes and get away with it. That was Irving Schiff, Peter Schiff's father. He said, here's how to cheat on your taxes. And that book was made illegal.
I didn't even know that. That's horrible.
Yeah. So the point is,
I would assume again that would be because it was the IRS who made that and not, again, that's not Congress. They really mess with you when they say Congress shall make no law, because there's other ways to make executive orders, for example, have the effect of law, but it's not Congress making a law. I would not be surprised if that IRS shift thing was a technicality like that. But yeah, I mean, aside from the state enforcing that, what makes that wrong?
Yeah.
Again, it's all a myth. Your obeyance is what makes it reality.
This sort of tension between the Free State Project messaging, which is on one hand, we're saying the amount of people who are sort of genuinely libertarian is very small. We can't win by, you know, arguing people into being libertarian. And then we're saying by being this small density of people in a single state, we're going to win, right? And so at a surface level, there's a tension between those two statements, right? And the resolution of that is that most people do not have genuine political opinions. Most people are agreeable. And that's why people became Nazis and why people are for the COVID regime, because most people go along to get along. That's how most people's psychology is, all right? And so part of the way, if we want to win, we have to be loud about what we believe, because that's what causes agreeable people to agree with us. But that's why, you know, in all those psychology experiments, you know, where they stage them and it's like, you know, four people give a lie and then the fifth person just echoes the lie, even though it's like disagreeing with their own visual cognition or whatever that I'm not getting the experiment well, but you know, this kind of thing, right? They literally have people lie and the people go along with the lie. Like this is if a lot of libertarians are disagreeable people, and that's not a bad thing. Disagreeable means independently minded is a more positive way of putting it. Right. Most people aren't this way. And so like, it's really important if we want to win that we be very loud and out there about what we believe, because that actually pulls the agreeable people to our side. Because the agreeable people are kind of, they're sticking their finger in the air and kind of going, what way is the temperature? and they go along with it. And right. So if we have these opinions and we're quiet about it and we hide it, we're not going to pull those people to our side. We're not. And so that's why I'm like, I think it's so important that if you're in a position as a Free Stater where you can be, you know, say your beliefs under your name, be really out there. And I think, I don't think that many Free Staters hide it. I'm not trying to say there's a bunch of people hiding it, but like, you know, I think that's really important because that's actually the most persuasive thing. It's not the logical argument of like why libertarianism is correct, but more like, I sincerely believe this. That's actually what's persuasive. It's just being out there and saying, I sincerely believe this.